I mean, it's true, if you could dispense with labor completely, the superintelligent would mean that you completely dispense with labor in producing new ideas. Then we can show theoretically that you can have a singularity. That means that in finite time, you achieve infinite income. But I think in reality, it won't happen because you will always need people, I think. I think you cannot dispense with, you know, with humans. And I will tell you why you cannot dispense with humans, because you need intuition. I don't believe that AI can give intuition.
Welcome back to The AI Element. I'm your host, Alex Shi. This episode of The AI Element is for those curious about economic growth, policy, and AI. Okay, so you're saying to yourself, that's not exactly what I'm interested in, but one can't deny that AI's development is hugely linked to this. On today's episode, we have a couple of international heavyweights to help us learn and understand why this is important, from the basics of how the advent of AI and IT technology actually affects growth to Japan's radical new approaches for guiding science and innovation. Countries across the globe are implementing AI strategies to not only keep up, but even try and create a new edge for themselves and their citizens. But the question we've been asking this season is, how do we make sure we're racing towards a positive outcome by developing AI the right way? Though each application of AI differs from business to business and country to country, there are similar patterns and concerns that arise. The fear that automation will increase unemployment rates and that AI will worsen existing inequalities. These concerns are very valid and they are real. And this is what economic policymakers have to deal with. How do they make sure they are helping create a positive outcome? Our first guest is Philippe Aguillon. Philippe is a world-renowned economist who could very well earn the Nobel Prize for his work on growth theory. He is the main advisor to French President Emmanuel Macron on innovation policy, is an advisor to the High-Level Commission on Economic Growth at the UN, and is a professor at three different prestigious universities at the same time. Recently, Philippe has been studying the impact of AI on economic growth, not just in straight GDP and productivity terms, but also in how the new income is shared. He's been looking at it in the context of various previous industrial revolutions. In fact, Philippe views AI as a continuance of the IT revolution, and so has been looking to the effects of IT automation for clues. As with previous industrial revolutions, this one is also characterized by a fear that automation will result in unemployment, which in the past has turned out to be unfounded. But while unemployment hasn't gone up, the increase in wealth has not been shared proportionately with workers. Philip also says AI presents some new, unique challenges, and even talks of theoretical financial singularity. But don't be alarmed. We'll walk back from that unlikely scenario and get an interesting economics lesson on how automation can actually lead to growth for more rather than just a few.
Recently, you had the IT revolution and the artificial intelligence, which for me, it's a continuation of the IT. I see IT and artificial intelligence not being two separate revolutions. I think one is a sequel of the other. And there is, of course, the same concern that it would destroy jobs. And the question is always, what will be the effect of the AI or IT on growth, and what is the effect on jobs? And of course, the difference is that AI allows for automation of tasks that you would think would never be automated, like, for example, driving a car, or, for example, giving medical advice. Now, those part of those tasks can be now done by, performed by machines. So it's automation on a much larger scale, and that begs the question, will maybe this time there might be a danger for employment, but also the potential for boosting growth is very large. And the question is it automatic that growth will be boosted and employment reduced, or do we have a different view? And the view is that, in fact, it depends very much on the institutions that are in place.
Philippe explains that this boost is in part because AI, which in economic terms is a form of capital, is essentially limitless and can replace labor, which is in finite supply. But he also notes that growth has been more and more unevenly distributed in recent decades by a greater presence of what he calls superstar firms that are creating a winner-take-most situation.
why is it that AI, you would think, would accelerate growth? For a very simple reason, is that you replace, or at least you add to labor, which is in finite supply, capital. You see, capital is something we produce ourselves. So we could produce as much as we want of amount of capital. So you replace as input in the production of goods and services or in the production of ideas, labor, which is in finite supply, by capital, which is in infinite supply. And that's what gives a fantastic potential for accelerating growth. That's what we explored in our paper with Jones and Jones. We showed that, in fact, even if you allow for, you know, automation in the production of ideas, you might, under certain circumstances, get what we call a singularity, where you could get infinite income in finite time. Of course, that's a theoretical possibility, and there are a number of factors that make it unlikely, but this outcome. But it's interesting that just the fact that you can replace, you know, labor by capital in the production of goods and services or in the production of ideas, gives enormous, you know, room for boosted growth. And so that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, we've seen that growth in the U.S., for example, in particular, has been, productivity growth has been declining. And after having been boosted during the decade between 1995 and 2005. So why is that, quoi? And I have this recent paper called A Theory of Falling Growth and Rising Rents, which I will send you if you don't have it already, with Pete Clino from Stanford and other co-authors, where we try to understand why is it that you had this big decline in productivity growth as of 2005. And now we are well out of the crisis. We are well out of the financial crisis. So it cannot be the financial crisis. And in fact, it has a lot to do with the superstar firm phenomena. But the bottom line is that the AI, if it leads to superstar firms becoming hegemonic, in fact, after a period of boost, because they are more productive, so when they expand, initially, of course, productivity growth goes up, but then when they expand into most sectors of the economy, they somehow discourage innovation by other firms, by non-superstar firms. And this discouragement effect is what drives the decline in productivity growth, you see? So the thing is that if the revolution allows some big firms, some superstar firms to dominate the whole economy, then it's very bad because dynamism goes down and innovation goes down, new firm creation goes down. And then you have the opposite of what you were hoping for.
Philip defines superstar firms as those with above average productivity in their category, earning higher margins with relatively less labor. And in an economy driven increasingly by platform companies with massive network effects, the gap between the superstar firms and the rest of the pack is widening. Philip shows us how these superstar firms are able to take over and how AI could scale those advantages in an unhealthy and unequal way, and argues that it will even reduce overall growth in the long term.
You know, suppose you are a superstar and I'm not a superstar, okay? So we both innovate, but for any level of technology, you get more profits than I do. Why you get more profits? Because you are, you know, your logistics is better than mine. You see, you have social capital that you accumulated. That's very hard for me to imitate. You have access to networks that I don't have access. You have access to data that I don't have access to. Maybe you are better than I am at optimizing on fiscal, on the taxation, you see? For all those reasons, you, for any level of technology, you get much more profits on any task than I would. So now what the AI or IT revolution does, it allows you and I to perform more tasks. You see, it saves on the time we devote to a particular task. Any firm does more than one thing. Any firm is in more than one product line or in more than one activity or in more than one, if it's Walmart or a department store, in more than one location. But of course, it takes time to control one more location or one more product line. What AI and IT do, it's to increase the span of control. It allows you to do more things. So it allows you and me to do more things. But in fact, because you are more productive on every task, you expand at my expense. You see what I mean? If you have the AI revolution or the IT revolution, what you will do is that you will take over many more product lines at my expense, because on each of them, you are more profitable. So what will happen is that you, the superstar, who is more productive than me for any level of technology, you will take over most tasks. In the short run, productivity growth will increase because you are more productive than I am. But in the long term, because you've taken over most of the activities in the economy, it will discourage me from doing R&D because I will have this handicap of this permanent advantage you have over me. You see what I mean? Even if I innovate, I have the handicap that I don't have the access to network, I don't have the access to data, etc. You see? And that's why you observe this falling growth after a rising growth period. For example, it has a lot to do with lack of competition. So for example, in the US, merger and acquisition are unrestricted. Like Facebook or Google, they can do merger and acquisition wherever they want. So the effect of this is that maybe in the short run, it will boost growth more because they will take even over more lines. But in the long term, it means that even more lines will be controlled by them, and therefore innovation by non-superstar will be inhibited in those lines. You see, will be stalled in those lines. So, for example, restricting merger and acquisition would be a way to counteract, you see, the effect of superstars on growth. And more generally, you have to rethink competition policy, maybe also to improve data access, so that if you have access to data, maybe it's not forever. You see, other people can also access data. And so the advantage that superstar firms have are not become less permanent. You see what I mean? So all those things, which would be part of a newly thought competition policy, would help restore growth, you see? So really, the bottom line is that AI has the potential to deliver more growth, but combined with bad competition policy, it can give the opposite. It can discourage growth. So you need AI with good competition. AI with bad competition is, in fact, a brake on growth, not a booster of growth.
There you have it. AI doesn't necessarily equal more growth, but instead amplifies disparities without the right policies and healthy competition. But as Philip mentioned, there are ways to increase competition and redistribute growth. Philip mentioned that a more developed financial ecosystem could help as well.
Well, anything that favors entry, competition means more entry, quite. Anything that favors entry, so entry you favor by, you know, making competition more level playing, you know, I mean, but also by having more people who can potentially come. So, for example, the financial sector, it's good to have developed venture capital, developed institutional investors that can help newcomers with new ideas to challenge the existing incumbents. So that also is very important. To have highly developed private equity, venture capital, institutional investors, that also helps boost and allow, you know, facilitate entry by newcomers, by new startups.
The recommendations that Philip gave so far were really at a national level. But he went on to emphasize that when dealing with the multinational superstar firms of today, we'll need global coordination to make these policies work.
First, you know, I mentioned to you that the superstar firms usually are better than other firms to escape taxation. So to coordinate on taxation, you see, for example, at the G7, there was a big discussion on taxing the superstar firm. And I think that should be done because otherwise they have an advantage, which is the escape taxation, better than others. And for example, insisting that they pay tax in the place where, you know, they make profits and not in the place where they, you know, do the research or whatever. That's very important. Going in that direction will reduce their superstar status. You see, that I think is a very important thing. Second thing would be to have good policies for sharing data, which would be worldwide, you see, and that would be good to coordinate on that. But that's not easy. So at least at European level, you can, because you have a competition commissioner and you can coordinate competition policy at the EU level. But unfortunately, you cannot go much beyond the EU when you do competition policy. The other thing they can do is to fight to renegotiate WTO. It's true that that China abused WTO. That was true. They abused WTO. So you have to renegotiate WTO, but still put an end to the trade war. That's something that countries can do together. Move away from a bilateral approach to a multilateral approach to trade, you see? So that, I think, would be something that at the multinational level can be done.
Philip gave an example that illustrates on a firm level just how this winner-take-most dynamic plays out and how automation will have a more mixed effect on employment than first meets the eye.
So first, I mean, I would say it's very interesting because there have been studies by colleagues of mine, Acemoglu, Restrepo, and we replicated what they did for France. If you look at the level of commuting zones, you see that commuting zones that robotize more over the period 95-2014, the employment went down by more. So if you look at the level of commuting zone, it looks like those places that robotize more had a bigger fall in employment, so a bigger rise in unemployment. So you might think then that firms that robotize destroy jobs, but it's more complicated because if you move the analysis from commuting zone level to plant level, you see that plants that automate more tend to, in fact, they create more employment, not they destroy more, they create more employment, particularly of semi-skilled and highly skilled workers, less so of low skill. So how do you reconcile the fact that plants that robotize or automate create employment and the fact that you see commuting zones that robotize more reducing employment by more? And the reason is that I think you have business stealing. In fact, what happens is that the firms that robotize or automate are those innovative firms. Those expand, but they expand by driving out firms that robotize less, innovate less. And those firms are driven out, and those firms, when they are driven out, they put people unemployed. So it's not that those firms that robotize, they destroy employment. It's those firms that are innovative, they robotize, they innovate, they expand, and they drive out other firms that robotize less. And it is those firms disappearing that's the source of growing unemployment. You see, that's kind of very interesting. It's a reallocation effect. It's a business stealing effect.
Now, we have to admit that no firm really wants to decrease innovation. Bringing it back to the firm level, Philip shows how AI can be a tool for creating the right environment for innovative thinking.
Well, I mean, for example, AI allows firms to be more decentralized. So that's a good thing, you see, because AI makes it possible for firms to increase the span of control and to become more decentralized. And we know that decentralization is a good thing for innovation. They should take advantage of that and be innovative. And AI, you know, when your AI helps you solve problems, and you can have your researchers devote more time to really go for innovative stuff, for, you know, disruptive innovation, because all which is about calculating things and can be done partly by machines. So you should take advantage of that to really put people to work on complicated problems, on new problems, and giving them a lot of power. You see what I mean? So really decentralize firm management more than ever when you have AI. Because if you don't decentralize, AI becomes a way to check on everybody's shoulders, and it will reduce the firm's people's initiative. If you want to maintain and boost initiative in firms when you have AI, you need to decentralize firms much more. I think is very important there.
Philip clearly sees AI as an enabler for human innovation, and in this paper points to what is known as Bulmo's cost disease, that growth may be constrained not by what we are good at, but rather what is essential and yet hard to improve. For Philip, that essential yet hard to improve thing is human intuition, the driving force behind innovation. For him, that is why he doesn't think we'll see an economic singularity with AI. And gave as an example his own mother, who, believe it or not, invented luxury ready-to-wear in Paris, also known as prêt-à-porter, and founded the famous French fashion house, Chloé.
I mean, it's true, if you could dispense with labor completely, and the superintelligence would mean that you completely dispense with labor in producing new ideas, then we can show theoretically that you can have a singularity. That means that in finite time, you achieve infinite income. But I think in reality, it won't happen because you will always need people, I think. I think you cannot dispense with humans. And I will tell you why you cannot dispense with humans, because you need intuition. I don't believe that AI can give intuition fully. Maybe I'm wrong. You see what I mean? For example, let me talk about my mother. My mother, she invented ready-to-wear, luxury ready-to-wear. And she invented that because she saw that either women were not well-dressed, or if they would dress well, they would go to haute couture, where they would have, the dress for them only, and with the husband going there and telling them, look, I want to please my husband. You see, it was a very different way. And my mother had a vision of a woman as a free woman, as someone who is free, who is working, who is active. She needs to have clothes which are easy to put, to wear, because she's an active woman. It was a vision of the woman, different. You see what I mean? Which was her vision that she applied to her own life. And that's how she invented the ready-to-wear, the prêt-à-porter de luxe, because she had a vision of the woman which was different. And I don't think AI can do that.
Philip felt very strongly about not replacing people with AI, which is something that he and our next guest have in common. Yuko Harayama is a former executive member of the Council for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy in Japan, and was a leader in developing Japan's national AI strategy. Japan is a country that is very familiar with advanced technologies, but has had trouble with getting ahead as a frontier innovator. To guide technology and innovation policy, they have relied on five-year plans developed by the Council for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. But the plan Yuko's council put out in 2016 was different. Rather than setting a roadmap technology development should follow, they instead presented a vision of the society they would like to have. They set guiding principles for how advancements in science, technology, and innovation should be used to get there. When we talked with Yuko, she said that they needed to shift focus away from technology and towards a human-centered society, and they called it Society 5.0.
By saying we have to address for our future unpredictable, unforeseeable, uncertain, in this case, we have to come back to the fundamentals. What is fundamentals? It's a kind of social value that we have to respect. And also saying that we have to fix some kind of principles to guide how you have to advance your technology. That's why, related to the AI, we try to formulate what we call social principles for AI. That's what's the way we try to tackle these challenges. So as a core value with my colleagues, we have identified, first of all, is sustainability, also inclusiveness, and also openness. And we didn't mention explicitly, but you can see through all the official documents, we are keen about diversity.
This new plan for the council changed not only the focus of the policy, it also changed the execution. In line with the values of openness, sustainability, and diversity, Yuko added that experimentation would be key when implementing new and existing tech.
The key elements, we have to test many, many technologies, one side. At the same time, at the policy level too, we try to invite to have experimentation-based policy making, in the sense that as you don't know what may happen in next year, in next 2-3 years, you may have some good ideas to change the society, but instead of applying to the national level, big project, you may start from small step, testing some new ideas. It could be a regional policy or a cluster policy or city smart cities-like policy. But anyway, you have to test on the ground, because otherwise, you never know what may happen. And you have to see what could be the interaction. But it may happen that you may encounter some unexpected impact, usually negative impact. But you have to test on the ground to see what's happened. And then you can adjust your way.
Both Yuko and Philip have emphasized the need to invest in people, as well as handing over more power to innovate to a wider group of people. But as Yuko experienced, proposing these ideals as a way of attracting criticism.
We have received many, many critics in Society 5.0. Some say you are too optimistic, it's too abstract, and many things like that. To these critics, we said, when you are surrounded by so many conflict geopolitics and so many uncertainties, you have to have some really positive thinking when you foresee the future. So one thing, and also when they said it's too abstract, how to translate in terms of businesses, in terms of politics, my answer was, it is open to everybody. That means we try to guide you, not impose to you what you have to do. It's up to you to really take advantage of policy framework in the way to express your view, your ideas, and please challenge your ideas. It is really a revolution in some sense in the formulation of policy. Because usually when you are at the government and you want to take actions, it's top down. You say, we have to go in this direction and you have to follow. We didn't take this approach. From top down, we say we will formulate the kind of principles. We need space for anyone to express their view, to challenge even the government. At the same time, we have to really make change in mindset of Japanese traditional officials, bureaucrats, and those who are in the high position. Because they have been trained and they used to operate in the opposite way, usually.
Yuko really changed everything in making this five-year plan. She even changed who sat on the Committee of Public Representatives that gave input on the plan's development. She told us that traditionally the council would pick representatives from large companies to sit on a committee when drafting a five-year plan like this. But instead, Yuko balanced the committee out with academics in philosophy, economics, and technology, as well as journalists and representatives of civil society. And she didn't do this just out of virtue or because it looked good. She really needed them to push the thinking of what will drive Japan's economy.
Basically, we said, as you know, we have very good reputation in manufacturing sectors. And the use of robotics, we have long history. That's why, from one side, use of AI in the manufacturing sector is really kind of natural thinking for us. So it's one direction. But at the same time, we have to switch at the Japanese level from manufacturing sector only into more service-oriented business in the way that more service-oriented application should be at the front of the top page. That's the key issues. For that, in more societal implication will be in the health sector of the demographic structure of Japan with aging society and all related social costs engendered by the aging society. One way is to really having more technological support within this sector. And another sector is really quite newcomer. Usually the agriculture sector was really a protected area and really organized in terms of lobbying structure in some sense. Today, we consider it's time to change the structure of agriculture. And one way was to take advantage of big data and really having more opening door for the young people to come to agriculture sector by making appealing this sector. One way would be to introduce AI and so on. So, of course, when I talk about manufacturing sector, you have some privileged industry sector, which is automobile. As you know, Toyota, Honda and Nissan, all these companies were successful to switch from traditional car makers into more hybrid and now moving to electric. But at the same time, we said one way will be really next generation. We have to really be the first to achieve autonomous cars. And for that, it's any more the question that each company will develop their own strategy, their own technology alone. But we have to have really kind of public space for that. And from the government side, we said we have conveyed all the companies and all the academia to have physical infrastructure, which should be really adapted to take advantage of all AI technologies. So one way was really focusing on three-dimensional maps that we will set up at the national level. And the idea being facilitating transition from ordinary traditional cars to into more autonomous cars.
Yuko's work has been paying off, with Society 5.0 getting traction at an international level and helping shape the conversation around global AI policy. But she also mentioned that the principles should be tested themselves. After all, one of the main tenets of Society 5.0 is openness.
There are many international fora about these issues. I was personally in touch with the OECD, for example, and you, Element of AI, you're very active. You are connected to many international debate on that, and you are playing a very active role for that. And that's good, because it's not only government official, those who are charged of international affairs, discussing about AI, but you have very private sector, business representative, and association from bottom-up association. And I think it's very healthy to have this kind of debate at the international level, because I have no idea in any other fields other than AI to have this kind of engagement from different types of stakeholders at the international level. So it's really positive. But by saying that, everything is brilliant, because you may have kind of protection of your national strategy, and also the topics usually not discussed on the open debate is the national security issues and defense purposes. So it's not a completely open debate. And then we have to mobilize different level of organization in parallel. It's any more one single institution at the international level fixing everything, because everything is moving so quickly. And then we have to have a continuous debate, discussion, to ensure that we are sharing the common value, that it's not just signing an agreement that you will ensure, but continuing to discuss and discuss. What we are doing actually is defining some kind of agreements on very high level of AI principles, social principles, and even now for the use of data management kind of principles. And now even for the security issues, United Nations, they are trying to really have common view on the principles. So that's good. But then second step will be how to apply these principles on the ground. And it should be domain specific. If you are working on business sectors, or if you're working on security issues and so on. So application principle should be customized to the geo domain. And then also you may have cultural background with that, as it is linked to the society. That means people's habits or people's practice are different. So we may see some kind of national differences on the ground level. And then we need to go back to the principles in the way to ensure that even customized, you are following higher level principles. And if it doesn't work, it's time to review the principles. It should be a dynamic process. What is important is testing your ideas on the ground and then open your idea and share your idea with others. And then we can have a learning process, because otherwise, you're waiting that some politician says you should do ABC, and we don't want that.
It's hard to express just how much effort Yuko must have gone through to change the way Japan makes its policy for science, technology, and innovation. And the challenge is not done. So just in case Yuko made it sound easy, I want to conclude with a last word from Philip about optimism.
What I can tell them is my vision of optimism. There are two ways to be an optimist. One way is what we call pangloss. You know, Voltaire had pangloss. And pangloss is someone who always says everything is for the best in the best of the world, okay? And you just do nothing and you think problems solve on their own. That's a very bad way to be an optimist. The other way to be an optimist is what the French resistance was, or any country's resistance. We know we have to fight. We fight for an ideal. It will be difficult. It will be painful. But if we fight, it's like Churchill. You see what I mean? You become Churchill. You say, I fight. That's another way to be an optimist. But you're an optimist because you will know you will fight, that you make history. On ne subit pas l'histoire, on fait l'histoire. You don't undergo history. You make history. So that's the other way to be optimistic, is to say, I can change things. I can improve the world. And it may take several times, and it may take, you know, being stubborn, like a researcher. That's my job as a researcher. Researcher, we always face difficult problems. We could give up right away, but we say we will go, and we keep trying and trying and trying until we find a way out, and we break the ice. That's my way of being an optimist. You see, it's the way to say, I know there is a solution, and we will fight for the solution. And it was not done overnight. So when you know what to do, you have to fight for it. It's not enough, of course, when you know what to do to make it happen right, like with a magic wand, but you know that you can fight for it.
Thanks again to our guests, Philippe Aguillon and Yuko Harayama. For more information on everything you heard in this episode, visit the links in our show notes or go to elementai.com/podcast. There you can find a bunch of sources of what we talked about, like some of Philippe's papers, Yuko's presentation of Society 5.0, and an article about Philippe's mother who founded Chloé and Prêt-à-Porter. You can also find a list of the different topics we covered with a timestamp of where it was in the episode. You can go back and re-listen to any section. Have a question we didn't cover? Tweet at us at @element_AI and use the hashtag #TheAIElement, and we'll cover it in an upcoming episode. The AI Element is produced by Simon Hudson, Amanda DeRupeau, Corey Selveson, and Edit Audios, Steph Colbert, and Ali Selwa. Theme music is by Bayonard and Lee Rosever. Our booker is Claudia Roderick. Visual design by Weiwei Lin. Shout out to our digital and promotions team, Kyla, Vince, Benoit, Jen, Robin, and Kevin. Finally, thank you to Anne, Christophe, Viara, Mary, and Marie for making this happen.